Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this podcast episode, author and former park ranger Jordan Fisher Smith was enjoying the well-tended archives of the National Park Service when he came across the story of Harry Walker. Walker was a young man from Alabama, gone west, on the road for the first time when he visited Old Faithful in Yellowstone National Park in 1972. What happened to Walker and how it changed the way we think about and manage the National Park Service is the subject of Jordan Fisher Smith's new book, Engineering Eden. He spoke at the Elliott Bay Book Company on August 17th. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum.
So good evening, all, and thank you so much for coming out this evening. It's my pleasure to welcome with us this evening Jordan Fisher Smith with his new book, Engineering Eden, the true story of a violent death, a trial, and the fight over controlling nature. He's also the author of Nature Noir, and his writing has appeared in such publications as Men's Journal, Los Angeles Times Magazine, among others. In addition to that, he was a park and wilderness ranger for 21 years in California, Wyoming, Idaho, and Alaska. He'll be reading this evening. I'm sure he'll be happy to take your questions. And then afterwards, books will be for sale at the back of the room, and he'll be back there to sign your book for you. We are recording with KUOW this evening, so you can look forward to hearing that on the radio sometime in the near future, I'm sure. So please join me in welcoming Jordan Fisher Smith.
You know, Elliott Bay Book Company is sort of like Tokyo Bay or San Francisco Bay, and the authors who are on the road like I am talk about these places. Have you been there yet? When are you going there? And they're like ports in the storm, you know? And many nights a week, somebody like me who's traveling is here. And this is a most amazing cultural institution to have in your city. To some extent, many cities that still have pretty good art museums don't have bookstores like this. And I hope that you who live here feel as lucky as I think you are to have Elliott Bay Books. And also thanks to KUOW for being here tonight and recording this. When we break nature or we damage nature, how do we fix it? I suppose first we turn our phones off. In the process, how much should we respect nature's autonomy? How much should we try to manipulate and control nature in order to save it or repair it after we've broken it? Do we know enough, really, about nature and ecology to do it? What happens if we get it wrong? These are the questions I've been thinking about now for about a decade. And there are some stories that come to a writer and refuse to be sent away. And the story I'm going to tell you about and tell you a little bit of tonight in Engineering Eden is one of those. It simply refused not to be written. It came to me in dribs and drabs over a period of years, and I slowly assembled it. In 2009, I was working on these questions that I've just mentioned and working on an article for Discover Magazine. And I was in the archives of Yellowstone National Park, which are particularly fine. Yellowstone, the flagship, this sort of oldest, first national park in the world, also has one of the most beautiful and well-tended archives of its own history. And I was in the archives in Gardner, Montana, and I sort of stumbled across these cardboard boxes containing 1,745 pages of trial transcripts from a forgotten lawsuit that went to court in 1975 in Los Angeles. As I began paging through the transcripts, I found that two of the greatest wildlife biologists of the 20th century were testifying against each other in this trial. And the trial was all about how do we fix nature and make it natural again? And what happens if we get it wrong and somebody gets killed? In this case, the person who got killed was a 25-year-old farmer from Alabama who had left home in a state of, he was in one of those times in life where he was a fork in the road, where he was trying to figure out what the next stage of his life was going to be. He was troubled by some things. He had been in the National Guard, and it was 1972, 2 years after Kent State, and suddenly being in the National Guard wasn't all that popular anymore. So he asked his father for a little time off from the farm, and he left home hitchhiking and went on the Great American Road Trip. He arrived in Yellowstone National Park in another centennial. We're having a centennial this year of the national parks. This was the centennial of the first national park in the world, which was actually designated in 1872, really early. That's 4 years before Custer's Last Stand. The final mop-up operations of the Indian Wars are going on around the park as it's created. Some people call that a genocide. And he arrives in the middle of the festivities celebrating the 100th anniversary of the park. And a few hours after the dedication of the new visitor center at Old Faithful and within view of the building almost, he is dragged away into the woods screaming and partly eaten by a grizzly bear. An environmental activist who's trying to save the grizzlies from extinction south of Canada, and at that point they are very much threatened with it, convinces his parents in Alabama to sue the federal government on the grounds that the federal government had been conducting a modification of the behavior of bears, trying to force bears back to naturalness, and trying to do couple of other things in the park to force the park back to naturalness. And the foundation of the suit was that this operation was carried out on a faulty philosophy that the best way to get something to be natural again is just to leave it alone. The plaintiffs claimed that this had resulted in one of these bears killing Harry Walker. These people, the Alabama farmers who lodged this suit against the federal government, had never so much as contested a traffic ticket. They had no idea what they were in for. They didn't know any lawyers. They'd never talked to a lawyer. And this was the beginning of a six-year odyssey for them that ended with the loss of their farm eventually, and they went out of business. This is also the story of a pair of researchers who took on the National Park Service over its philosophy about making the park natural again. And for their trouble, the Park Service sent a bulldozer to push down their lab and eventually cut their radio collars off the grizzly bears and forced them out of the park. And I should say that when I talk about the Park Service is an old institution. It's been with us now for 100 years. And the Park Service I'm talking about is very much the Park Service of 1972 or 1970. And I'll talk about that later, but I don't want to confuse the Park Service we're talking about here with today's Park Service. However, the issues at stake are very much the ones that we're facing now. If you break nature, how do you fix it? How much do you respect nature's autonomy and stand back and let it sort itself out? how much do you reach in, and truly what is natural and what's not natural, and is anything natural anymore? I heard a moment ago that I would be reading, and you know, usually when I do these talks, I read a little bit, but I talk a lot. And it even before that was said, it occurred to me that I might read a little bit tonight from this book, which I don't usually do longer sections of. Would you like that? Do you like when authors read? It certainly works on the radio. I'm going to read to you a little bit of Engineering Eden. And in this scene, Harry Walker is still at home in Alabama. And it looks like he'll be just living his father's life forever. He's going to be taking over the farm. Life will be as it's always been in dairying in Alabama. And he hasn't reached this crisis yet where he's leaving home. The problems in Yellowstone's ecology is out of balance at this point. In fact, in this book, you'll see that a number of the great national parks' ecologies were out of balance. The national parks became a physical manifestation of our ideas about what nature was and how it worked. And the oldest ones became a sort of sequential manifestation. There were layers of policy on policy on policy as we learned about nature. Keep in mind that when Yellowstone was created in 1872, there was no science of ecology yet. It didn't. There was no professional association for ecologists. There was no teaching ecology as a distinct field in universities. That really didn't happen until, there were ecologists by the 1890s. There was a professional association by the time of the First World War. But this is a civilization that did something very bold to create a 2-million-acre reserve of country that hadn't really been damaged all that much yet. And at the same time, they had no idea how to do it. Once they had drawn a line around it, nobody had ever done anything like this before. And their ecological knowledge was typical of their time. So from the very beginning, Yellowstone, Yosemite, Sequoia National Park, Glacier National Park became manifestations of our learning process about nature. And if you know what to look for and you go to Yellowstone, you can still see these old policies written on the landscape. This is true for the other parks as well. So in this chapter that I'm going to read, there's a lot of trouble also with elk. In Yellowstone, as was typical at the time, they killed off all the predators. They killed every last wolf by 1926. They killed off all the cougars. At least no one saw one for many decades in the park. The grizzly bears were saved because people found them interesting and fun to look at. Largely this was a park where ungulates like deer and elk were allowed to the population was allowed to grow. And by the time I'm writing about here, this had caused some serious problems. The park looked very moth-eaten. Whole forests of aspens were refusing to reproduce. There weren't any seedlings because the elk were eating off everything that came up out of the ground in the winter when they were really hungry. So the Park Service had, by 1934, taken to shooting elk by the thousands in Yellowstone. They'd have these great herd drives and drive them into corrals and then shoot them. So you'll meet this ranger who later investigates the death of Harry Walker. The first thing we see him doing in the park is herding elk into corrals. By this time, they're being trucked away and given away because somebody's objecting to shooting them. And with the problems with bears, by the 1890s, bears were feeding at every garbage pit around the hotels in Yellowstone. First black bears and then grizzlies. There were people feeding bears. Almost as soon as there were tourists in the park, the activity of feeding bears became an expected part of going to a national park. And so this was a powerful way of modifying the behavior of bears, which are smart creatures, to lose their reticence to come close to people. And as they came close to people, there were increasing problems. With black bears, which weren't predatory, they merely would get pushy and push somebody over or claw them if they wanted food. And with grizzly bears, which mostly stayed away from people but fed at the garbage dumps, they would occasionally take people. They'd get close to people. And what began to happen was very scary things with grizzlies. Chapter 21, Fire Hole. By 1970, Harry Walker had become a familiar face in the smokehouse, a brick-fronted billiards hall with front windows looking out on the main business district of Anniston, half a block from the white marble courthouse where Assistant U.S. Attorney Spivak later took depositions from the Alabama witnesses in the lawsuit over his death. He was a grown man now, 23, 6'1", long and lean, all muscle and gristle, with a ready smile that showed his big, even white teeth. He dressed in blue jeans, tight white T-shirts that his mother kept bleached, and plaid shirts. He liked to shoot pool, and the smokehouse was also part of a whole mosaic of side jobs he cobbled together for extra income. He was collecting the money from the players and racking up the balls and working for the owner there. Although he worked long hours on his father's farm, the dairy didn't clear enough to pay him a full salary. So in addition to the smokehouse, at various times, Harry worked on the night shift at the pipe foundry, spent a couple of weeks on an oil rig off the Gulf Coast, and crewed aboard a shrimp boat out of Mobile. Based on his experiences with farm machines, the National Guard trained him as a heavy equipment operator, and he brokered his skill into yet another job running a backhoe for an Anniston construction company. When the mail carrier on the Walker's rural route was looking for a substitute for vacations and sick days, he asked Harry. Harry applied, and he got that job, too. Harry's life was laid out before him. Like the cows that had worn their habitual trails in the red clay from the lower pasture to the milking barn, Harry would mark the hours of his life treading the same paths his daddy did, at least for now. And at least for now, he would have to work those other jobs as well. At Yellowstone that spring of 1970, a newly promoted 30-year-old sub-district ranger was sent down from Mammoth Hot Springs to take over the day-to-day operations of Old Faithful Village. Jim Brady was not a big man, but he had played college football, and he exuded physical confidence. His manner was thoughtful, polite, and deferential. He had a way of making people feel like they had his total attention when they talked to him. And among his subordinates, he had a reputation for being preternaturally cool in emergencies. Brady had grown up in San Bernardino, where the smog drifting east from Los Angeles met the dust and tumbleweeds of the Mojave Desert. His father was a brakeman for the Santa Fe Railroad there. And when Brady was 14, his old man was hit by a train and put out of work. As the family slipped into poverty, Brady discovered football, which earned him an athletic scholarship to Humboldt State University in the coastal rainforests of Northern California. In addition to lumber mills and muddy scrimmages, Humboldt was known for turning out foresters and wildlife biologists. Brady majored in botany and zoology and married his high school sweetheart. By the time he graduated in 1962, he was working as a seasonal park ranger and very much wanted to be a permanent one. That summer, his wife gave birth to their first child at Yellowstone National Park. Brady's specialty within the Park Service, as opposed to a scientist such as Glenn Cole or a ranger naturalist like Lloyd Parrott, whose job was to give out information to visitors and teach people about nature, was to make sure the coming and going of millions of visitors went smoothly and to see to it that they went home in one piece. In the early 1960s, when Brady came on the scene, the Park Service was diversifying its traditional fare of awe-inspiring scenery with new parks where the emphasis was on pure outdoor recreation. Brady got his first permanent job in 1963 at one of these, Lake Mead, the reservoir formed by the Hoover Dam on the Colorado River just outside of Las Vegas. Lake Mead National Recreation Area was a 24-hour bacchanal of alcohol, high-powered boats, firearms, and assorted other weapons. It was a gladiator school for young law enforcement rangers. By the time he transferred back to Yellowstone in November of 1967, Brady had been shot at 3 times. About the first thing they found for him to do when he got back to Yellowstone was to fly around the Lamar Valley as an observer in a helicopter, chasing elk through the snow into winged fences and corrals that were by then referred to not so affectionately as McGee traps. After the beating the Park Service had taken in Senator McGee's hearings that March, they weren't shooting any elk, and as Glenn Cole implemented the natural control program, it was the last time they would give them away. 984 of them that winter. I should say that Cole believed that the best way to make something natural again was to leave it alone. And the opposition, and in this case it was John and Frank Craighead, the grizzly researchers, said that no, once things are out of kilter, you may have to manipulate them back into shape in order for something that resembled naturalness to happen. And this was the great fight in this book. How do you get nature to get back to what it would be had you not messed with it? From the helicopter, beneath a ceiling of snow clouds, the Lamar Valley was a study in blue, gray, and black, and orange where a shaft of low sun stole under the weather to light a distant peak. It had been snowing, and the icy wind had blown powder off the ridges and into the gullies and low spots where it settled in hundreds of parallel paths that generations of elk had engraved into the mountainsides in their desperate search for sustenance. The elk trails stood out as white lines across the stony slopes, like the contours of a topographic map. The helicopter shook as the pilot swooped back and forth, herding strings of elk through the deep snow in the gullies. After the mayhem in Las Vegas, for Brady, it was like coming home. And from the tiny bubble-canopied craft, the immensity of the valley and the white elk paths were beautiful, and it all looked convincingly like wilderness. Brady made a good account of himself in 1968 and 1969 in the North District at Mammoth Hot Springs, and in 1970, he was made the Old Faithful Subdistrict Ranger. Old Faithful Village is located on the Grand Loop Road in the valley of the Firehole River in the western part of Yellowstone. The meadows surrounding it are bounded on the east by the timbered ridges of Observation Point and on the west by the dark lava bluffs at the western edge of the Madison Plateau. In those days, the village contained some 400 buildings, the greater number of them tiny brown-painted guest cabins and other small structures. The ruling presences were two large historic hotels on the north end, facing a semicircular plank causeway around an aperture from which, at intervals of just over an hour, the Old Faithful geyser erupted over 100 feet in the air. Beyond the geyser, paths and boardwalks extended north into the upper geyser basin and up the rounded white slope of Geyser Hill. The hill and the valley in the distance were dotted with clouds of steam rising from geysers and hot pools. The Grand Loop Road had been constructed by Army engineers in the early days as a dirt wagon track. By 1970, it was a 142-mile strip of asphalt, 22 feet wide, connecting Old Faithful to the other clusters of hotels and cabins, stores, cafes, visitor centers, marinas, and campgrounds in the park. These features constituted less than 5% of Yellowstone's total area, but absorbed over 95% of the ranger's energy. A project to divert the road around Old Faithful Village was completed for the centennial summer of 1972. But when Jim Brady took over in 1970, on an average summer day, between 11 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon, from 600 to 800 cars, trucks, buses, motorhomes rolled right through the village. At intervals of about 65 minutes, when the geyser went off, drivers of passing cars would stop in the middle of the road, everyone would pile out with their cameras, and the Grand Loop Road would become gridlocked in both directions. There was no getting a patrol car or an ambulance through, and as one of his first administrative actions, Brady put in a request for a motorcycle. Vehicle fires, forest fires, lost children and pets, fist fights over parking places or other imagined slights, spousal disputes, thefts, and the delivery of emergency messages to call home about the death of an aunt were part of the job. Brady's life was a strange juxtaposition of quiet, sage-scented moments watching elk and bison grazing slowly across the meadows, and other moments that embodied the whole intense pageant of human existence, from birth to sudden death. In June of 1970, he found himself stepping gingerly toward the edge of a pool of boiling hot water in the upper geyser basin with a rope around his waist, held by another ranger, and carrying a bucket of strong soap. A 9-year-old boy walking through the geysers with his family had stumbled off the boardwalk and fallen into the pool. His mother and father heard the splash and turned around to see him surface with a shocked expression, then sink and die. He was boiled until the meat fell off his bones. It has been known since the turn of the century, when it was done for the entertainment of tourists, that soaping the hot springs caused them to bubble more violently. This action caused what was left of the boy to rise to the surface, where Brady and his rangers skimmed about 8 pounds of the remains for burial. With all of that, the second stage of Anderson and Cole's closure plan, and this, by the way, is the plan to close the dumps. The bears have been feeding at these dumps now for 80 years, and really pretty much it's not a problem. In other words, there's no people at the dumps. The bears show up there and eat the garbage, but there's no actual conflicts really going on out there. But now, Cole, who's the chief biologist at the park and the superintendent, will naturalize the park by making the park appear to be natural and closing the dumps. The problem is that that behavior in higher animals is part of ecology, that an animal will behave. An elk or a bear is a different elk or bear depending on what kind of behavior they have. And they function entirely differently, and that's what they're about to find out with this closure. With all of that, the second stage of Anderson and Cole's closure plan made things twice as bad at Old Faithful that year. The bears displaced by food reductions at Trout Creek awoke that spring to find workers bulldozing dirt over Rabbit Creek and installing an electrified fence around a temporary landfill at Nez Perce Creek, a couple of miles north. There were no power lines there, so a generator ran 24 hours a day, and a maintenance worker was assigned to monitor it. Alone out there at night, he witnessed huge grizzlies getting sparked off the fence, and as Brady understood it, was so unnerved by the experience that he refused to go back. Meanwhile, in a cooperative effort with the state of Montana to keep grizzlies off garbage along Yellowstone's boundaries, the town dump at West Yellowstone was closed that summer. However, as Steven Zetterberg forced Starker Leopold to admit during his cross-examination at the trial, bears did not respond by suddenly switching to an all-natural diet. Quote, June of 1970 was exactly 2 months long, Brady remembered. Brady and his rangers spent their days dealing with people and their nights dealing with grizzlies. Scattered in the pines on the south side of the village was housing for Park Service and concession employees. At night, grizzlies wandered the unlit gravel roads there, past the dormitories, houses, and trailers, looking for something to eat. So Brady and his rangers were setting culvert traps, tranquilizing the bears and relocating them. Around the 4th of July weekend in 1970, a trap was set right in front of of Brady's trailer. One night, he was awakened by the sound of the steel gate clanging shut. Luckily, his wife and three little girls were up at Mammoth Hot Springs at the time. It was about 2 a.m. He got up and looked out the front window to where the porch light cast a pool of light around the trap. Sure enough, it was sprung. Grizzlies mate between May and July, and Brady knew that around that time, if you trapped a female, there might be a male nearby. He got on the phone and woke up Mike Warren, a bear management ranger, and asked him to get his patrol car and drive through the housing area to see if there were any other grizzlies around. Warren drove around, spotlighting the woods, for about 15 minutes, then radioed an all clear and pulled up in front of Brady's trailer. Brady came out to meet him, leaving the trailer door ajar as the screen door sprung shut. The two of them peered into the trap and saw a sow they'd handled before. Suddenly, Warren said, "Run!" Both men sprinted for the safety of the trailer, dove underneath the porch railing, and tumbled right through the closed screen door, demolishing it. Brady slammed the trailer door behind them as a big male bear attacked the porch in frustration and went over the trap with the female inside and started banging on it with his paws. Brady got out a dart pistol, sat down at the kitchen table, and loaded a dart with enough sacostrin to put down a big bear or instantly kill a human being. His hands were shaking with the adrenaline. As he finished loading the pistol, he accidentally discharged it. The dart missed Warren and lodged in the ceiling. Brady loaded another, walked over to the door, cracked it open, and darted the big male with the first shot. The bear ran off into the darkness. Brady and Warren got into Warren's car and drove around the housing area looking for the bear. Time went by, enough for the animal to have been immobilized and then come to again. Finally, they saw a light on in a small travel trailer and heard a woman screaming. The bear was up against the side of the trailer, trying to turn it over. Brady darted it again. This time it went straight down. The two rangers went back to anesthetize the trapped female bear and towed the trap containing her over to the second bear. They woke up a couple of other rangers and tried to drag the big male into the trap, but he was too heavy. So they went and got a pickup with an electric winch, snaked the cable through the trap past the sow, winched the male in next to her, and slammed the gate. The 6-year-old male had been transplanted twice before and was sent to a zoo. Brady isn't sure what happened to the sow. That is how it was at Old Faithful in the summer of 1970. Anderson and Cole had ordered dump closure to proceed, and Brady was determined to make it through the year without a serious bear incident at Old Faithful. He almost did. Or maybe he did. We may never know, because amid the daily chaos and all the good deeds of the Rangers that summer, key evidence thought to be fragmentary human remains was mishandled and lost. And although Jim Brady could not have known it, the old grizzly that would later kill Harry Walker passed through his hands. Frank Craig had learned about the macabre discovery along the Firehole River near Old Faithful after it happened. When in the fall of 1970, he struck up a conversation at a store in West Yellowstone with a young man who turned out to be an off-duty seasonal ranger. This is now a testimony from the trial over the death of Harry Walker. "Would you tell the court the conversation you had with Ranger Schroeder at that time?" Zetterberg asked Craighead on the witness stand. "Well, for the first time was the evening of October 10th, 1970, when I inadvertently started talking with Gerald B. Schroeder, seasonal ranger," responded Craighead. "I then realized that he had more than average knowledge about the situation at Yellowstone, so I asked him who he was, and he told me. Through him, I learned of the possible mortality at the camp along the Firehole River. At that point in the conversation," Frank testified, "he removed a notebook from his breast pocket of his shirt and began taking notes as Schroeder continued his tale. He said that in the Old Faithful area in 1970, there was probably or possibly another human mortality, but this apparently had not been recorded or released to the public. Schroeder had told Craighead that an abandoned camp had been located, apparently torn up by a bear. Cans found there were mouthed and squashed, but not punctured. And Frank, sleeping gear had been dragged a considerable distance away from the camp, and a tuft of human hair had been found. There were indications that possibly a human had been killed at this camp, and no other evidence was apparently found. The camper never showed up, and the camp was removed by the rangers, Frank testified. Not long after that, he told the court, an old bear with broken teeth had been trapped at Old Faithful and flown 18 miles into the backcountry. Certainly, a bear moved that distance, only 18 miles away, in my experience in transplanting them and tracking them by radio, would readily come back. So there's a good possibility that the bear that disturbed this camp could have been the bear that was in the Walker Boys camp, Craighead testified. This story actually came to me, as I said, in pieces long before I discovered the trial transcripts. When I was 26, I briefly, writing my first magazine article and working outside my ranger cabin one day, and some bear management people and bear researchers had trapped a sow and a cub, and the trap was parked down near my cabin. I went down to see what they were doing, and I watched a man named Dr. David Graeber work the bears up and measure them and check them for ectoparasites, pull a fourth premolar to age the bear, describe the distinctive blaze that the bears sometimes have on their chest, and fit them with radio collars. These bears had been working the campground at Lodgepole, and they'd been responsible for all kinds of mayhem. They then put these bears in the back of a truck and drove them to Redfur Heliport, and loaded them on a Hughes 500 helicopter and flew them into the backcountry to be released where they wouldn't be a problem for people and people wouldn't be a problem for them. I was dazzled. I got to say that at that time I was in the process of gathering my skills as a ranger, and this idea of taking these animals out of a situation where they were causing trouble and moving them to some place where they could live a natural life really attracted me. And I thought, this is good work. So I put in for a bear technician school. And the following year, I began working briefly with bears. And, you know, basically doing what I'd seen them doing, trapping bears, tranquilizing them, taking various scientific data off them, and then fitting them with radio collars and moving them to places where they wouldn't be a problem. Well, years later, when I was casting around for a writing project, I thought it would be a good idea to go back and see what happened to every bear that I ever worked on. It was 17 years later, and the records of all the bears that I had worked on were still in existence. And as I began to go through them, I found the most remarkable and shocking thing. Every bear that we ever touched, every bear we ever worked on, came to a bad end very soon. We hadn't saved anybody. We weren't doing anything other than putting off the inevitable invention of the locker that you now see, or the inevitable installation of the locker that you now see in every campground. Moving bears around doesn't work. It didn't work for us. It didn't work at Yellowstone. And so the shock of this made me want to pursue it more and find out more about it. And I went back to this Dr. David Graeber I had seen that first day, who was now the chief scientist for the Pacific West region of the National Park Service, and began asking them about the whole activity. And through this, learned that he had been the student of Starker Leopold, the son of Aldo Leopold, who becomes a major character in this book. So I interviewed him more about Starker Leopold, and in the process of this interview, he had said that he sort of had gotten his job with the Park Service because of a scandal at Yosemite involving the discovery of 20 dead bears at the bottom of a cliff. Things had gotten so bad in the campgrounds at Yosemite that the rangers were killing bears and throwing them over a cliff on the way up the Crane Flat Road. And a rock climber by the name of Galen Rowell discovered the 22 corpses of bears and had a press conference. This resulted in a scandal. Graber also told me that at the time, there were a bunch of people from Yellowstone who had fled Yellowstone and come to Yosemite after some kind of lawsuit. I didn't hear another thing about that lawsuit for years until 2009 when I discovered these old files at Yellowstone, and the case kind of came together for me. This story is really about how much do we believe our own assumptions about nature. And in charting the story from the beginning of Yellowstone, we see layers and layers of these assumptions as ecology changes its ideas. First, ecology, through much of the 20th century, was a highly organized and interdependent, laced-together system. And then suddenly later on, somebody decides that it's all very random and patchy, and it isn't as interdependent as we thought it was. And each time in the actual operation of parks, somebody changes something based on a theory. So this book, Engineering Eden, is about the way in which the cost of thinking we know about nature. I'm curious whether anybody ever had any experience with a grizzly here. Did anybody ever visit? That's about as close as you want to be to a bear. The gentleman says that we have KUOW with us, but gentleman says that he actually was close enough to have a clawed paw of a bear. Right, yeah. And this relationship with food, with human food, ended up being a huge behavior modification program that was done inadvertently by human beings. And so in the time that I became a ranger, we were doing all these things to the bears to try to get the bears to behave right. And what really needed doing was to separate bears absolutely from sources of human food. Interestingly enough, that you'll find in the book that this Dr. David Graber, who appears later in the book, actually invented the food locker at Yosemite. It's now in every campground. And with the canisters that backpackers carry now, it has utterly changed the relationship between bears and human beings everywhere that these things are being used. And all the things that we were doing to the bears themselves didn't really make any difference. Bears have an amazing ability to navigate. You can anesthetize them with powerful veterinary drugs, put them in a helicopter, fly them into the backcountry, and somehow when they wake up, they know the way home. They often get back. When we were using the traps that we towed behind vehicles, they often got back before we had a chance to tow the trap back. Anybody else have an experience with a bear? In Yosemite was a terrible place in the 1970s. There were literally bear incidents constantly every day. And in the mid-70s, quite a few injuries, actually, from black bears, which very seldom happen anymore. I'd like to have time to talk with you when I'm signing books also. Do anybody have any questions about what I've said? I think what I've written this book about is, I meant this book to be, let me say something about this, the form of this book, because I think the press has commented on it. Engineering Eden was built in its form to resemble ecology. I had the idea that I wanted to write a book about the complex relations between people and places and nature and the way that they are incredibly interdependent, the way that ecology appears to be. As I say, there are two bodies of thought about ecology in this regard. One is that everything is random and patchy, and the other is that that nature is incredibly interdependent and it co-evolves. Individual organisms co-evolve together to become a a fabric, like in the Sanskrit tradition, Indra's net, the idea of the infinite interrelationship, you know. And this is also in the Western tradition. Herman Melville says, we cannot live only for ourselves. 1,000 fibers connect us with our fellow men. And among those fibers, as sympathetic threads, our actions run as causes, and they come back to us as effects. So I built the book to be a model not only of a story, which it is, and the way that science happens, which is constantly with scientists arguing with each other and their interrelationships, but also as a model of ecology itself. You'll find that the stories in this book, which are all true, somehow all relate to each other, and the characters somehow have met each other in or been altered, have their lives altered in surprising ways. You know, Martin Luther King said, it really boils down to this, that all life is interrelated. We are all caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied into a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one destiny affects all indirectly. So the book was built, when you read the book, if you read the book, you'll find that it's, and I didn't make these things up, but you just, if you begin looking at them, you'll find that that's the way life is actually constructed. Your life is constructed in this way. You are related to people. Certain people did something or said something at a certain time in your life that changed everything for you. You did something that changed everything for someone else. And that's the way this story was connected.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum, featuring author Jordan Fisher Smith. Again, you can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.